A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 40. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are talking about Red Dwarf. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. We're 3 million years from Earth, and the last human and his cat are boldly going in search of a curry and some stylish clothes.
This is aboard the mining ship Red Dwarf, which is a rather large mining ship which holds well over 100 crew members. Dave Lister and Arnold Rimmer are the two lowliest crew members, Lister being a third technician, the lowest ranking person on the entire ship, and Rimmer being the second lowest ranking member on the ship. And Lister is something of a loafer and a slob and just does what he can to get by and not very ambitious, where Rimmer is ambitious but not terribly competent. Rimmer is also a jerk. He's an idiot who always gets on Lister's nerves.
Yes, that's right. They're, as we're going to hear, they're quite the odd couple, really, who annoy each other intensely. And the story of Red Dwarf is going to kick off, and we'll get this all explained in the first episode, because Dave Lister, our central character, he smuggles a cat on board this huge mining vessel, and he gets caught for bringing an animal on board, and he gets sentenced to 6 months in a stasis tube in some form of suspended animation. And it's while Dave Lister is in this stasis tube that his sort of odd couple buddy, Arnold Rimmer, will cause the accident which will basically wipe out everybody else on board the ship. And he manages to flood the ship with deadly cadmium-2 radiation, which is a bit of a disaster.
It is a disaster. It kills the entire crew, except for Lister, who is in suspended animation, in stasis, and Lister's cat, who was safely sealed in the hold, and Lister's cat just happened to be pregnant. Well, Holly, the ship's computer, lets Lister out of stasis once the radiation has cleared to a safe background level. 3 million years later. By this time, 3 million years, Lister's cat has not only had kittens, but the kittens have evolved into humanoid form, specifically into the species Felis sapien, and the cat race has its own civilization on Red Dwarf, which has left Red Dwarf and mostly been killed off. But there is one remaining cat who becomes a major character in the series.
So as you can tell, we're talking about this very wacky science fiction sitcom from the BBC called Red Dwarf, which ran for 8 series between 1988 and 1999. Although, as we'll say, there were a few gaps during the production. But it had 8 series, 52 episodes of about... They were between 25 and 30 minutes each episode, I think, Brian. Slightly variable in length, some of them.
That's about right.
During this time, they are going to cover a variety of science fiction themes and cliches and plot devices, and they're going to do it in such a humorous way. It's a classic BBC comedy science fiction show. We've talked about previous ones. We've talked about Hitchhiker's Guide, and this is certainly another one of the great approaches to comedy in a science fiction setting.
It was a great combination of comedy and science fiction, because the comedy was always there. It was always strong and keeping you guessing. The science fiction went from sometimes doing a satire of the typical sort of cliche sci-fi plots, and at some points it would go to some pretty original stuff and some really quite solid sci-fi at the same time as being filled with humor.
Absolutely. So if you're not familiar with Red Dwarf, let's catch up on who the main characters are that we've started to talk about already.
Yes, the central character is Dave Lister, who, as we said, was the lowest ranking crew member on Red Dwarf. He is lazy, irreverent, addicted to spicy Indian curry food, and generally a slob, but not incompetent or unintelligent, but just unmotivated and generally slobby. Lister was played by Craig Charles, who before Red Dwarf, I think, was mostly a stand-up comic and I think did some sketch comedy work. He was known as a punk poet. So he did a variety of things, but I think his direction he was coming from with the comedy was sort of the stand-up and sketch comedy line of things.
And then, as we've said, his opposite number is this very uptight, repressed character called Arnold J. Rimmer. He reappears in the series because it's established in the first episode that the ship's computer on Red Dwarf can maintain one holographic representation of a dead crew member. And for reasons which become apparent later on in the series, the crew member that the computer brings back after 3 million years is Rimmer, the second lowliest technician on the ship, and the complete opposite in a way to Dave Lister, because Rimmer is he's uptight and he's fastidious and he's very neat and particular, but he's also, as you've said, he's a bit of a jerk. He's cowardly and stupid, and he has this completely overinflated opinion of his own abilities. He's convinced that there's only a few minor obstacles barring his way to high office on in the Space Corps. And Rimmer was played by Chris Barry, who'd previously been best known as an impersonator, an impressionist, and had done a lot of voices on a show called Spitting Image, which was a political satire puppet show. I don't know, did that make it to Canada and America, Spitting Image?
Yes, it did.
Right. So he used to do a lot of the impersonations on that show, and he played Rimmer in fantastic style throughout.
And his ability to impersonate almost any voice and any set of mannerisms was definitely used from time to time in Red Dwarf, and to good effect.
It crops up here and there, yes.
We also, of course, have the cat. The cat, as we say, evolved and is a descendant from Lister's pet cat. But this character, the cat, is meant to be like a cat in his personality. So he is obsessed with himself and knows who number one is. He's obsessed with his appearance and what he's wearing, and going after women, even though there are no women there, always thinking about sleeping with women and so on. And you know, fascinated with shiny things and little things moving around and all of this sort of thing. He also sort of moves like a cat. He has a very graceful sort of formed way of moving, where he'll sometimes tumble a little bit, or he's doing spins and things all the time, especially in the earlier episodes. The cat was played by Danny John Jules, who was a musical theater singer and dancer, and he played this like an acting role, but with those sort of singing and dancing tools just sort of wedged in there to great effect. So that was a performance that was always entertaining.
Yeah, he's fantastic. I mean, as you say, in the same way that Chris Barry was allowed to do some of his impressions in later series of Red Dwarf, there's a couple of moments during the series where they let Danny John Jules do some singing and dancing, and you can see that's his natural environment, that he's extremely good at it.
Yes, he is. And even just the way he moves and the way he speaks sometimes, especially in the first couple of seasons, are very much influenced by his background as a singer and dancer.
And there's a couple more characters we'll mention as the sort of main grouping, although actually for a show which had wiped out just about everybody in this radiation disaster, there's quite a number of characters in Red Dwarf, but we'll mention a couple more. Crichton, the robot, or to be precise, a Series 4000 sanitation mechanoid, who turned up briefly in one episode in the second series of Red Dwarf, when they rescued him from another ship, a derelict ship they came across. But then from series 3, he became a regular cast member, and he, as befitting his program, he was delighted by menial tasks, and he was seemed to be happiest when he was cleaning toilets or doing the ironing or preparing food for Dave Lister. He has this quite charming sort of way that he slips into different modes, so he can engage what he calls smug mode or guilt mode or even occasionally lie mode. And in the later episodes, as he becomes a regular member of the team, it's quite fun because Lister is encouraging Crichton to rebel against his programming, and Lister's rebellious spirit is trying to infect Crichton in a way. And Crichton the mechanoid was played initially, when he first appeared in that single episode, he was played by an actor called David Ross, but then the man in the suit, or the man in the rubber mask, who took over from the third series was Robert Llewellyn, who really made the character his own and has been with Red Dwarf ever since.
Yes, Crichton was a great character to have in there, because he was the smart one. He was the one always figuring things out and doing the explaining explaining of what's going on, but at the same time, he was focused as his main role in life, folding sheets. So it was quite an amusing thing, and again, it was very well played.
I think Crichton, played by Robert Llewellyn, is probably my favourite character on Red Dwarf. He just gets funnier and funnier as the series progressed.
Yes, he was always fun. And we also have Holly, who was the ship's computer, initially played by Norman Lovett for the first two seasons, and for another three seasons by Hattie Heyridge. Norman Lovett also came back for the final season, Series 8, and he was in the very tail end of Red Dwarf 7 as well. But Holly was the ship's computer, displayed as a head, a talking head on a screen. So this was, yes, an actual talking head. Holly had suffered from computer senility after 3 million years of being left out in deep space on the Red Dwarf. Holly is pretty clueless at this point and was initially supposed to have an IQ of 6,000, but is no longer so brilliant, to say the least. Holly has a lot of one-liners, and for those first couple years when Crichton wasn't there, Holly was doing a lot of the exposition and explaining of things. But Holly, when Holly was there, first as the male Holly, then as the female Holly, then as the male Holly again, was definitely a key part of the show and added a lot to it.
Absolutely. As you say, this idea they introduced of computer senility was used to very good effect. He does seem, or she, seem more and more useless as time goes on, don't they?
Yes.
This is an SOS distress call from the mining ship Red Dwarf. The crew are dead, killed by a radiation leak. The only survivors were Dave Lister, who was in suspended animation during the disaster, and his pregnant cat, who was safely sealed in the hold. Revived 3 million years later, Lister's only companions are a life form who evolved from his cat and Arnold Rimmer, a hologram simulation of one of the dead crew. I am Holly, the ship's computer, with an IQ of 6,000, the same IQ as 6,000 PE teachers.
So the production of Red Dwarf. Red Dwarf was created by a writing team, two chaps called Rob Grant and Doug Naylor, who had been writing together for many years already. And in fact, they'd done lots of the sketch writing for the Spitting Image puppet show that we mentioned that Chris Barry did the voices for. And they worked together for so long that they'd actually sort of formed the sort of partnership and even a production company with parts of their name. So they formed this sort of almost this group organism called Grant Naylor. And I think it's Grant Naylor Production that appears at the end of the episodes and also on some of the other spin-off materials that we'll talk about with Red Dwarf. And they'd been producing some BBC radio comedy as well, and in particular on a radio sketch show they were writing a series called Dave Holland's Space Cadet, which again featured Chris Barry, although this time he was playing the voice of the computer in this particular science fiction sketch. And I think it was from that show that they started to get the ideas which they would turn into Red Dwarf, of a human millions of years away from Earth with only a computer for company.
Yes, those were from the early 1980s. They feel quite dated. It's quite an old style of radio, but there was some fun stuff in there, in the ones that I've heard, and definitely some of the ideas for Red Dwarf were starting to come in. Red Dwarf was produced, much of it, by Ed Bye, as well as Rob Grant and Doug Naylor producing as well. And for much of it in the early years, Ed Bye was also directing, and Paul Jackson came on as director. And between the two of them, Ed Bye and Paul Jackson, they directed, I'd say, most of Red Dwarf. There were some other people who came in and directed at different times, including for part of the fifth season, Rob Grant and Doug Naylor directed as well as writing and producing.
That's right. I think they had another director who was having trouble with the science fiction format and actually had to drop out. And that's, I think, when Grant Naylor took over themselves.
That's right.
And it started off as a BBC Manchester production when it first came out, the first few seasons. From season four, they moved from the Manchester studios to the Shepperton Film Studios for the production. And that, I think, gave them one immediate advantage, which was much more room. And I think they were able to build bigger sets, and they were also able to rehearse in the sets that they'd built rather than in very small rehearsal areas. And I think that shows in some of the series from sort of four, five and six onwards.
I think for the eighth series, they were again in a bigger space.
Right.
And the music for Red Dwarf was written by Howard Goodall, He had a lot of fun with that in playing with different things. He wrote a theme song with lyrics that goes at the end of episodes of Red Dwarf that was sung by Jenna Russell. He also wrote a lot of incidental music, much of which was quite serious and fairly heavy sounding, which sort of offset the comedy. In particular, for the first couple of series, there was an opening theme that was an instrumental that was quite somber. And he also parodied different kinds of things at different times and wrote sort of showpiece numbers as well. So there were quite a few things that he did with the music that were quite neat.
Now, the Red Dwarf theme that he wrote for the first two seasons, as you say, I rather liked that, and I think I preferred that. As you say, it was rather somber and downbeat, but it was rather effective. And then I think from the third series onwards, they replaced that with this rather rock guitar version of the end song for the opening credits, which I know has always been the subject of a little bit of dispute between Red Dwarf fans as to whether that was better or worse than the previous one.
And that original theme was occasionally used later on in the incidental music as a theme for the ship, for the Red Dwarf.
And then, as you say, Jenna Russell sang the song, which is it's a fine song. And she's quite interesting because she's cropped up in the new Doctor Who as well as an actress, isn't she?
Yes, she has.
I think, like Danny John-Jules, she's a London musical actress, but she's actually turned up, I think, in the first season of the new Doctor Who. We talked about some of the characters, in particular about the two main characters, Dave Lister and his counterpart, Arnold Rimmer.
And in the first couple of seasons, it really was based around Lister and Rimmer. The other characters, the cat, Holly, they were sort of peripheral. It was really about Lister and Rimmer and their relationship, which was that they could not stand each other. You had Lister, who was basically a slob and a loafer and just wanted to do whatever and have fun. And you had Rimmer, who was organized and focused and drove Lister absolutely nuts by being totally obsessive about everything, while Lister drove Rimmer nuts. And in the first couple of seasons especially, they had what were referred to as the bunk scenes, where you had the crew quarters where they had these bunk beds, where Rimmer was in the bottom bunk, the big bunk, and Lister was in the bunk on the top. They would be lying in their bunks and bickering with each other. And there was some great character chemistry there. Craig Charles as Lister was good, and Chris Barry as Rimmer was even better, and the chemistry was really strong. So much of this series is about character chemistry. And the way it started was all about Lister and Rimmer going head-to-head. And in later seasons, that was not as pivotal, but it was always still there.
And as you said, it was the odd couple in space. As you say, you've got the slob and you've got the uptight, almost perfectionist, fastidious Rimmer, although he's not as competent as he thinks he is. And as you say, they bounce off each other, and it's just great characters all the way through Red Dwarf. And then interestingly, because Rimmer is this hologram who's been brought back from the dead by the ship computer, and it does seem rather odd at first as to why the computer brings back Rimmer, who seems to be the person on the ship that Lister would get on least well with, and I suppose in particular why the computer didn't bring back one of the female members of the crew, and in particular his sort of former romantic interest, Kochanski.
Or would-be romantic interest, depending which part of the series you go by.
Absolutely, yes, because that does change a bit, doesn't it, as to whether she was his girlfriend, or whether they'd just broken up, or whether he was just interested in her.
Yeah, at the beginning he was just interested in her, and later on they sort of changed it so they had been a couple beforehand. But even if Holly had brought back Christine Kochanski, she wouldn't be able to touch anything, so one does wonder how useful it would have been for Lister.
Absolutely. And we find out later on in the series why Holly chose to bring back Rimmer, and he chose Rimmer as being the person most likely to keep Lister sane, and that Holly was concerned about the last human 3 million years from anything going insane, and that having his sort of nemesis Arnold J. Rimmer brought back would keep him focused and give him something to, I suppose, rebel against.
This, of course, plays into Holly and his computer senility, yeah, and not always having the most firm grip on things.
It's very much a character-driven sitcom, and I think particularly once they get beyond the first two seasons of Red Dwarf, they really get the balance right of the four main characters plus Holly the computer. I mean, we've talked about Kat, this sort of descendant of Dave's pregnant cat that he's smuggled on board. And I think, I mean, in the first two series, it's fairly well sort of established that the cat was fairly well a sort of single joke character. And the joke was that he just liked looking at himself in a mirror and was particularly obsessed with his appearance. And it's, I think, when they get to the third series that they managed to round out him, the cat, a bit more and give him more to do and more to say. And they make more of Danny John-Jules's abilities, which I think actually, if I remember rightly, they actually signal by giving him a song and dance routine right at the end of series two or at the start of series three.
It was in the last episode of series two that Danny John-Jules did the tongue-tied, basically song and dance number, which was very well done and quite funny. And of course, they explain why it's happening as well. But in the first couple seasons, he had a lot of one-liners. He had a lot of one-liner sort of jokes throughout the series, but it was at the beginning sort of a lot of one-liners and a lot of jokes about just, he's a cat. He's obsessed with his appearance. He likes to eat, and he's a cat.
And he does these sort of cat-like, meow-like yelps that he did in the first two series, which they seem to drop, I think, later on. And as you say, just give him a bit more to do. And then they also, I think they just complete the group with Crichton's introduction in series three. Although, you know, he'd already appeared in one episode of season two, but then he becomes a regular member of the team. I suspect they'd realised they'd gone as far as they could go with the Odd Couple in Space after those first two seasons of Red Dwarf, and that they needed to sort of widen the cast slightly, and that's why, you know, they gave Cat and Crichton much more to do.
There was a big change in tone when the third series started and they went to a more sci-fi type of feel with going around in smaller spaceships a lot more and going to different planets and moons and lots of these sci-fi ideas coming in, and they started being sort of a salvage team where, because they're so far from Earth, you know, the first couple of seasons they were just using up the supplies they had. After that, they started salvaging other ships and other space stations and things and getting gear and supplies and so on. So it did definitely evolve into much more of a sci-fi show with a team of people in the third season, but it still retained the comedy. It still retained everyone disliking Rimmer. It gave you a fun sci-fi show that was really strong on sci-fi and comedy. But part of what made it at the beginning and what continued to make it in that sort of slightly different format was the comic character chemistry. It was really all about the character chemistry and the comedy in a way.
Absolutely. And it just, you know, as we keep saying, it just worked brilliantly. I mean, particularly when they were in the sort of the pomp of the middle run of seasons, and just some of the funniest stuff on British television.
Yes.
So what is it?
I've never seen one before. No one has, but I'm guessing it's a white hole.
A white hole?
Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. A black hole sucks time and matter out of the universe. A white hole returns it.
Is that thing spewing time back into the universe?
Precisely. That's why we're experiencing these curious time phenomena on board.
So what is it?
I've never seen one before. No one has, but I'm guessing it's a white hole.
A white hole?
Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. A black hole sucks time and matter out of the universe. A white hole returns it.
Is that thing spewing time back into the universe?
Precisely. That's why we're experiencing these curious time phenomena on board.
What time phenomenon?
Like just then, when time repeated itself.
So what is it?
Only joking.
Okay, so it's decided then. We consult Holly.
Hey, wait a minute. I missed a discussion.
We all did. Time is occurring.
There were a lot of sci-fi themes that they explored throughout the series. They did some very original things, but they also took on a lot of standard classic ideas like time travel and paradoxes. I think they had some kind of time travel or alternate timeline involved in almost every season of Red Dwarf, if not every series of Red Dwarf. It was really coming up all the time, but they had a lot of fun with doing a sort of satire of some of these ideas like time travel, where they go back to when the crew was still alive and try to get someone else to go in stasis to save them. Or they would go back to Earth in history for one reason or another. All sorts of things of this type.
As you say, they have enormous fun with time travel paradoxes, and just about everything you can think of they will cover at some point during Red Dwarf. But they also run through all the other science fiction classics. So they have fun and games with DNA in one episode, and they find a DNA manipulator which produces all sorts of strange effects. That's when Crichton is briefly transformed into a human to a great comic effect. And then they also use the DNA manipulator on one of Dave Lister's curries and produce an enormous creature from a mutton vindaloo, which wreaks havoc and threatens them all, and forces Dave Lister to transform himself into a parody of RoboCop to deal with it. So that works very well.
They also had various kinds of androids, or simulants they called them, which were the evil androids. So you had, again, things very much like a RoboCop style of things. And the idea of these cyborgs and robots that have gone wrong and are trying to kill everyone. They also went into genetically engineered polymorphs and genetically engineered viruses and creatures of all sorts of bizarre descriptions. In one of my favorite satires that they did was body swapping, where they took this rather cliche idea that we've seen in the original Star Trek and in the Avengers and in all sorts of series of two characters swapping bodies. Well, they did it in Red Dwarf, and they made it fresh again because of the humor. They made it absolutely hilarious.
It works fantastically, that episode. As we say, they keep having fun with all this science fiction stuff. Another classic one is the original Star Trek series episode Mirror Mirror, which where they have the sort of parallel universe with subtly altered versions of the main characters. And again, a bit like the time travel paradoxes, it's something that Red Dwarf came back to several times, where they would find alternate versions of themselves through a variety of different methods. They meet the sort of good and bad versions of themselves in an episode called Demons and Angels. But there's other episodes where they meet, in particular, I think we have to mention two of the notable alter egos who almost became characters in their own right. One of them is where they meet an alternate version of Arnold Rimmer, who goes by the name of Ace Rimmer. And Ace Rimmer's fantastic. I mean, he's Rimmer from another dimension, and he's everything that Arnold Rimmer is not. He is heroic and brave and dashing and intelligent, just everything that that the Red Dwarf version of Rimmer it cannot be.
And Chris Barry, being the great comic actor that he is, carried off this great dual personality of the twit idiot Rimmer and Ace Rimmer, and pulled it off beautifully, and did a very humorous and dashing and suave and extremely competent Ace Rimmer, often playing off a split screen effect with himself in the same scene as the twit idiot Rimmer.
It's just fantastic. I mean, Ace Rimmer is this boy's own hero. He is just, you know, everybody who meets him sort of finishes their conversation with him with the expression, what a guy. And of course, the great thing is that when Ace Rimmer and Arnold Rimmer meet, they can't stand each other. Arnold Rimmer can't stand him because he's everything that he can't become. And Ace Rimmer just can't bear to meet this version of himself who's useless. I think Ace Rimmer was such a popular character that he turns up again in future episodes. They return to him a few times in the future. And then there's another very notable alter ego, which I'll just mention quickly, which is when Cat meets his sort of parallel dimension nemesis, a character called Dwayne Dwibley. And again, such a popular character that I think he reappeared in two future episodes. And again, Dwayne Dwibley is everything that the Cat was not. Dwayne was geekish and had a terrible haircut and terrible clothes and terrible teeth, and was completely unalluring to the opposite sex. And when Cat is either transformed into Dwayne Dwibley, or meets him, he just cannot bear it. The Cat is so vain about his appearance that Dwayne Dwibley just sends him to distraction.
Yes, Dwayne Dwibley was a great character. He was a complete klutz, where the Cat was very graceful and all of these things. It was, again, done very well. The one thing that we don't have in Red Dwarf, are aliens. There are a number of things that come up that make you think maybe you saw aliens in Red Dwarf, but they actually had a conscious decision on the production side that they would not include aliens, and they gave us a number of genetically engineered creatures that they would always explain as being from Earth. So you had the polymorph, which was genetically engineered from Earth. You had a genetically engineered virus, which came from Earth. They eventually introduced the Gelf, Gelf being short for genetically engineered life form. They were these sort of very odd-looking creatures that are sort of dislikable and can be nasty and generally try to avoid people. And then they had the simulants, which were these androids, but unlike the mechanoids like Crichton, the simulants are quite violent, and some of them were created as warriors for a war that was never fought and had these big war spaceships. And in other cases, they were just sort of on their own. So they had all these different things coming up to give you weird and wonderful things that gave you all kinds of interesting stuff there. But they always originated from Earth, and they never had aliens show up.
As you say, just a variety of different ways of encountering other characters and other life forms.
Right.
So next time, we're back to talk more about Red Dwarf.
We'll get into some of the spin-off material and potential remakes, revamps and adjustments and all these variations of things that are out there for Red Dwarf.
And also, we've got to get to our favorite bits and our favorite episodes. And as we've called it, and I'm sure everybody would call it, we need to talk about the good, the bad and the smeg.
And we will explain that remark next time. You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you can find us there. So thank you for listening. This is Brian from Canada, signing off.
And this is Eamon from England, saying please check back for the next episode, and goodbye for now.